all the leaders of the church, those whom God has designated. We see their qualifications in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in Titus 1. But we'll see the thread throughout the New Testament of their work in particular and the words that are used to describe that. We're going to start with the word elder first, the title, descriptive title of elder. We're going to break it down and look at it according to the scriptures. And then secondly, we will look at the overseer, the second section. And we'll see what that means and entails. And then shepherd will be the final one. Pastor is also used, but it is a very cognate word that is comparative to the word for shepherd. So I won't deal with it exclusively. I'll make note of it. For instance, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11, when he talks about those who prepare the church for the work of ministry, he describes that one group as pastors. In Philippians chapter 1, when Paul addresses the church at Philippi in chapter 1, verse 1, he'll talk about the overseers there. We'll be looking at that in particular. But the word pastor and shepherd, again, we will work together. The elders of the church. And our objective, I hope, by the time we get to the end of this one and the end of all of them, is to see the very particular aspects that make them who they are. Who they are according to God's design. And in Acts chapter 14 and verse 23, at the very early days of the church, by the time you get to Acts chapter 14, the church is a mixed group. There are several Gentiles in the church, maybe not as many as they are Jews at this stage, but there's certainly Gentile converts. And this church has grown. The Lord's church has grown throughout the Asian continent as well as into Syria and Jerusalem and Judea. In Acts 14, 23, when they had appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. Of course, the reference of they would be Paul and companions. Elders were appointed in every church, and there was a prayer over that, and every church had men who were qualified. Well, he calls them elders. What is the word elder? What does the word elder mean? Well, first of all, in general terms, it means those or one who is older of age or maturity. In fact, and as Strong's will tell us in his definition, that it is an old man, it can be eldest, it can be an eldest woman. It's one who is designated older or of elder age, someone advanced in their life, senior or a forefather. It's the ideal of the term of rank, especially when you get into the construction of the patriarchs, as we read in the Old, those who have a certain rank. And of course, when you talk about the Jews and the hierarchy, rank. When you look at the New Testament, and when we reference the Jews in the Gospels, it's that member of the Great Council that are often called elders, the ones of the Sanhedrin that might judge a matter. And so they would be rulers, judges at times. They would be selected among the people. There are all kinds of ways, I'm sure, that elders, in the general sense, could have been selected and used. But again, the key element in the definition is the maturity, the age factor, and therefore making them especially qualified. So that's where we're going to stay this morning. Now, what is that? What is it about that age factor or maturity that makes them so qualified? Unfortunately, we know older men who are not so mature in their habits or actions or conduct. And that is a sad commentary for them. There are some who have not prepared themselves with wisdom, and as we will talk about, and doing those things that would help others to learn new things, to learn how to act and conduct themselves. So they're not qualified to give good or wise counsel. We've known, even with the Jewish council, they were not always honest men, were they? And they gave poor counsel at times. They certainly revered their traditions, the traditions of the Jews that had been established over the centuries, more than they revered the law of God. And so we know that an eldership, a council such as that, can become very corrupt. And yet we note that in Matthew, the 23rd chapter, verses 1 and 2, even Jesus would refer to them in a certain, in a particular respectful way, which I think would give you an indicator that he understood and respected this kind of counsel, this kind of leadership. for all that it was worth, notice what Jesus tells his disciples. When Jesus spoke, well, to the crowds as well and to his disciples, he says in verse 2, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Okay, so they're in this judgment seat. And by the way, when he says they have seated themselves, they have not usurped any authority. That's not what he's arguing. In fact, when you go back, remember Jethro would tell Moses that you need to have men to help you with even the smaller matters. You can't judge all matters. It'll essentially wear you thin. You need assistance with that. And that's, I think, the impetus or how we get the 70 or the 72, however it's been denoted, the council of elders. By the time you get to the Jewish, the Christian age, of course, they've already been well entrenched. By the time you see Jesus talk about them, of course, you understand that these are men of judgment. And so what does he say about them? They've said in the chair of Moses, therefore, he says in verse 3, all that they tell you, do and observe. But do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. Now, I'm not making a case here for elders to have that kind of authority or responsibility, nor is Jesus really saying they're approved by God themselves. But he says, essentially, as long as they're there, I know what they have to offer you, and I want you to hear them and observe what they're saying. But be careful not to do what they do because they're going to lead you astray. That would be very akin to what Paul said in the Philippian letter in Philippians chapter 1 when he talked about those who for envy's sake would preach the gospel. They were envious of him and they were trying to denigrate him and minimize his apostleship while he was in prison. There was probably a lot of charges that they made. Well, if he really was an apostle, why is he there? Why is he in this prison, you see? And by the way, look at what we're doing out here. Aren't we doing the same thing? And we're the free ones and so on and so forth. They're very jealous of him. But what does he say about them? Make sure you shut their mouths and you stop them. No. He says, let them continue on because what they're preaching is the gospel of Jesus Christ and men and women are obeying that gospel. And he says it twice. I rejoice in that. And I say again, I rejoice. Again, not for their approval, but for what they do. So we can understand that elders can be, again, not who they should be. They might be able to give counsel, but it's always possible to have those that are corrupt in that way. Again, it's not a divine approval. It's not saying, hey, that's good. That's why we should have them anyway, no matter what. I'm just simply stating a fact that when we describe this title that God has designated to talk of that group or those persons who would work in this special capacity, then we have to have men who have a certain amount of knowledge, as we will see, a certain amount of maturity, therefore their age will help them achieve that. In Matthew, the 15th chapter, verses 1 and 2, the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, you know, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? So we already note that again, as we mentioned, that they will do things that they should not do. And so we need to find what a good elder looks like. We need to describe that work that befits that title well so that we can have exactly what they had in the New Testament church, what God wanted, what was appointed, and do that. And by doing that, we will improve the health and vitality of the church, no doubt. We'll be able to make sure that the church not only is pure, but it is a growing and a working entity that God, again, can approve of, that the light will still shine and the light will not be extinguished. Paul would call the Ephesian elders to this beach in Miletus in Acts, the 20th chapter. And he would call the elders of the church to them. And that will be a central theme, especially when we get into the discussion of overseers and shepherds. But for suffice to say, we know this same group of people called overseers and shepherds were designated at the very beginning elders. And they were called together because there was something very important for Paul to tell them. And therefore, we need to appreciate how important the elders are to the church. Paul wanted to let them know, I need to let you know some things that you need to be aware of and pay attention to. I can't be with you. I can't get there to you, but I want you to come to me so that I can tell you these things, or I will not see you again. Paul saw how important it was to help the elders of the church to know their job and to do it well. In Acts the 15th chapter in the great Jerusalem council, we discover there's elders there among those who are trying to decide this very matter. In other words, examine what God had given them in respect to Gentile converts. What is it that they are to keep? What are the Gentile converts are to keep? Well, in Acts the 15th chapter, verse 22, it seemed good, it says, to the apostles and to the elders and with the whole church. So the elders are included in that number, that they would choose men to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. And then, of course, they would send this letter out, and they would explain to them what was given to them or delivered to them by the Holy Spirit. The elders were a part of that council. In Acts the 16th chapter, of course, the letter was delivered. And when they passed through the cities, they were delivering the decrees which had been decided upon by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem. So, again, the apostles, what we note, were the special ambassadors that Jesus had appointed that would be his special advocates, the ones that would have the ability to impart gifts, that would guide the church in its early days, that would make sure that the word of God would be preached in its accuracy. Yes, and on occasions like Paul, they would have companions that they would send out to aid them in that, such as Titus, Silas, Timothy, Barnabas, and so on and so forth. And yet there also was a group of men which would not have a temporary stay, but their design was to be permanent. Inasmuch as they live and had the acumen or the ability to do this job, they would do it. They would be men, again, as we've already noted, that would have to be of age. Men that would have to be able to know what it means to be an elder. Because, again, they would have to give counsel. They would have to give judgment. And giving counsel and judgment are vastly important. Apologize, but that slide is the last slide. I don't know why we're backwards. We'll work our way backwards. Well, they're mixed. They were called elders because of their wisdom. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 6. Age is a factor here because he says they're not to be a new convert. So they will not become conceited and fall into condemnation or incurred by the devil. In other words, if they were new in the faith or they're very young in the faith, they wouldn't be qualified to handle the matters of difficulty and challenges that the church will face. They wouldn't be able to teach one well in what they needed to do to grow and mature in the faith. They're learning these things at this time. That's why they're called elders, you see. They're not new converts. So therefore, age, again, is the factor. Not the only thing that we have to judge, but it is a primary reason that they were called elders. Otherwise, why are they called elders? What does the title mean? It's arbitrary if it has nothing to do with age, but we understand it did. And therefore, they were qualified to lead in this way. In Titus chapter 1, Titus tells us in verses 5 and 6, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you, namely, if any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife." And he says, "having children who believe." That's a very important indicator. As I understand that text, that means one who has children who are faithful to God, not just faithful to their parents, not just talking about children necessarily even at home at this point, but nonetheless, they have children who believe. Well, in order to do that, you would have attained to at least a certain age. Again, age is a factor. Why? Because wisdom is necessary. We generally obtain wisdom by and by. We gain it as we learn things in our lives, as we grow and mature. That's exactly what we discover in Titus really as well when you look at chapter 2 and he says, to the women in particular, but I think it would also be implied even with the men, that you have older men as well as older women who are responsible for the teaching. In other words, verse 3, older women likewise are to be reverent and their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good. Notice, teaching what is good. There are teachers. How are they capable or able to do that? Well, they've attained to an age, experience, and they have a maturity, so that they may encourage the young woman, he goes on to say in verse 4. Again, wisdom. Wisdom's an important factor that we cannot deny. And we've got to have that. That's why they're called elders. We've got to have those who can impart the good counsel and knowledge and the warnings that are so necessary. You know, in Exodus chapter 28 and verse 3, you get this wisdom factor even in simple things such as the construction or the making of the garments. In Exodus 28 and verse 3, there's instructions for the making of the priestly garments. And notice what is said. God tells Moses, he says, you will speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom. And they will make Aaron. So we're not, of course, necessarily talking of age, but he says that they have a certain wisdom as well as skill in order to accomplish that task. In 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 6, when David gives counsel to his son Solomon before he dies and what he will do when he comes into the king, he says, I want you to act according, notice, to your wisdom. And incidentally, this is before he's prayed to God that he would receive wisdom. And the wisdom that he would receive even later would be even greater. A very special one, for sure. But wisdom was important, wasn't it? To make good decisions, to answer tough questions, to handle challenging issues, you see. Well, he says to him, according to your wisdom, you will do this. Proverbs chapter 1, and in Proverbs in particular, you might argue, is a book, in essence, about wisdom. Really is. I mean, really, if you look at all of what Solomon has to write, particularly Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, the ideal is that we need to be seeking wisdom. Wisdom should be something that we cherish and treasure because it is that which will not only guide us, but preserve us, keep us secure and safe. The Proverbs opens up in this very way, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge, and discretion. You see that? Verse 7, we've done in our study with the children. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, right? But fools despise wisdom and instruction. All right, so wisdom is an important factor in the qualification of an elder. Because he's attained to a certain age, he's had experiences in life. He's had challenges, yes, no doubt. He's made mistakes. There's no question about that. It's not that he's perfect in every way, but he's learned, hopefully, from that, and that's the ideal. He is capable to be an elder because he has learned from those conditions and those issues, and he knows what not to do next time or how to change something or to correct something. And the things that he did well, he knows how to counsel. That's why those of us who are older, those of us who are older than those that are younger are capable of telling them the things that they need to learn about youth, about their life, about marriage. Those who are married for a long time can help young people. Just as the elders are responsible in every spiritual way, in every spiritual avenue that we have to impart that. And really, that's a fundamental and characteristic and importance of their job. That's why I started with this wisdom. There's two component parts, but wisdom, again, is the fundamental principle. And because they've matured to get to an age, they're able. They're able to understand certain things. That's why he will continue on like you see in Proverbs, verse 8 of chapter 1. Hear, my son, he says, your father's instruction. You see that? And he'll go on through that. And so God would intend that the elders would be those who could impart instruction. And yes, have submissive persons to hear that instruction. In James chapter 3, verses 13, he says, Who among you is wise and understanding, he says. Let him show it by good behavior, his deeds and the gentleness of his wisdom. And hopefully that's exactly what we would see in an elder. I would argue that that's what we have to have if we understand that title well. One who could, with good behavior and deeds, be able to impart wisdom because they have wisdom and understanding. So an important, very important component, you see, to that. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 17 through 21, he will talk about elders who rule well. They're considered worthy of double honor, of course, as he talks about there. And he says that you would not receive even an accusation later on down there, except for on the basis of two or three witnesses. Why would that be the case? Why are we not to receive an accusation against an elder except for two or three witnesses? He goes, well, he's got the title. You know, nowadays, that's really what we think a lot of times. Somebody's got the position or title, you just don't do that. That's not a good reason. There needs to be a really good reason for it, and God gives us one. It's because bottom line is that based upon his qualifications, assuming those things are true, that he has the understanding and wisdom, that he would know better than the person accusing, and it is very possible, and we would hope very likely, that the accuser is the false one, or the accuser's got something wrong, or does not understand what they're seeing or saying. In other words, that the accusation might likely be very false if indeed this person is an elder. Because why? They already have the wisdom and the understanding, and that their way that they would proceed and pursue their lives would not be such an egregious way that they would have to be called out in this fashion. I'm not arguing that they could not sin, but I'm saying whatever this is something that has brought some type of reproach in the context, and therefore something needs to be dealt with in this fashion. But we know from Matthew the 18th chapter, verses 15 through 17, that even the dealings with one another, we need to be very cautious and careful in our approach. Sins can be handled in such a way that they would be inappropriately handled. They would not be taken care of wisely. That you start off with the dealing with it personally, one-on-one. And I don't necessarily believe that he's talking about a personal error. In other words, you sinned against me, although that could be included. But that if I understand this right, that a person has sinned and sinned in such a way that needs to, obviously sin, they need to be dealt with, that you're willing to go to them to talk to them about that. Then, of course, you would bring others with you. And here he says, you don't even bring an accusation against an elder, but two or three witnesses. It doesn't come before the church yet, you see. And yet at the same time, as we will see later on, it's going to be an important element, but that all of us need to remain very humble and all of us stand before God. We're all before God. And so be very cautious and careful. So that's why. Why do we not receive an accusation against an elder except by two or three witnesses? Simply because they've attained to a certain wisdom. And we may say, as it were, have egg on our face if we were to do otherwise, in part. We may cause disruption, problems, challenges. We can cause things to become very divisive and strifeful. We need to be very careful of these sorts of things. Why? Because of these persons have achieved to a certain thing. That's why children need to be very careful in their respect for their parents. It's really along the same lines. It has everything to do with that age factor. It isn't just merely age, but at the age based upon, again, wisdom and understanding that we tread very lightly. Not because the older person cannot sin. It's not that the older person cannot make mistakes. But it's because, again, that we understand that we may get it all wrong and we may be very well wrong ourselves. So therefore, wisdom is an important part, and that's what we need to be looking for. Men who have the understanding and the wisdom because of attained age. And I'm not going to talk anything about what that age looks like. There's a lot of debate sometimes about that. But I think we understand practically that it requires one who has obtained to a certain amount of experience, practice, understanding, observable life, and of course, because of that, they've got to an age. As we've already noted with believing children, there is, again, a pattern there that shows that person's wisdom and understanding. The other component part is their work. But what is their work? I mean, it has to be an important, an integral part. Why? Well, it tells us that. In fact, in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, it says it very plainly. They're able to teach. And let's just be plain about that. That means they're able to teach. Let me say, what context? Well, we get all up in arms about that argument. They'd be public teachers, their shyness, etc., and so on and so forth. And the problem is that we have really reduced it down to some functionary action that really doesn't have meaning or basis. When that text says is able to teach, that means they've, as we've already noted, have the wisdom and the understanding that they can take the word that they have learned and learned well and applied already themselves and then help you to apply it also. No matter what context, no matter what situation, whether it be one-on-one, whether it be in group settings, it doesn't matter. Whatever's necessary, they're going to do it. Able to teach. We cannot deny that part. And the point that I'm making about this is that a lot of times we focus so much on, the logistics. You know, well, does he have to stand before a classroom of people? Does he have to stand in the pulpit, etc.? And before you know it, we have really lost the importance of this definition and understanding. Just as we oftentimes spend so much time on the domestic qualities. We're worried about so much of that and we forget other things. It's not that we neglect or we leave that aside. It's just that we make sure that we're balancing everything. We're looking at all, whether it be the moral components, personal, whether it be the reputation components as far as the community and persons are concerned, or whether it's his domestic qualities, just as we need to consider his teaching abilities. He needs to be able to teach because he knows the Word of God. So what does this teaching and wisdom look like? That's where we're at now. What is this teaching and wisdom? If I understand the definition, and that's what I'm offering, you can correct me if you believe that I am wrong, but I will say this. Contained within the context of the title elder are two components. One begets the other. A person who is wise because of their time that they have spent upon this earth practicing their life as a Christian. The time that they have spent in their youth and developing their character in God. And putting that to practice and learning the Word. And yes, along the way, teaching as well. But now they become a greater teacher, a master teacher, as you will, if you will. Should be. I think that's really God's intent, is that they would be the master teacher so that the church would be safe and secure. So what does this teaching of wisdom look like? Well, we need to be able to find out what that would look like in order to do it well. And the first thing that I would notice is humility has to be a part of that. There's another text there then in Peter that Paul will talk about this very quality of which he is an elder himself. And so he's stressing this as a very important component. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 4 and 5, he says, for whatever is born of God, wrong book. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposing is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humility. That's true with all of us. We all need to obtain that. But it needs to be a special and important quality of an elder. Humility. And by the way, it's in the likeness of the chief shepherd, as you'll notice there. Well, we have the Gospels to teach us about that chief shepherd's humility, don't we? And we'll look at these in future lessons, but notice in John chapter 13, the washing of the disciples' feet. That's an humble experience, isn't it? Humiliating experience. What about him being a guarding of the door? And we'll get into that when we talk about him being a shepherd. Here's a man who is the shepherd. He is standing before the door. These sheep have one who will sacrifice for them, you see. There's a humility there standing before the door. John 17, that very deep and intensive love in that prayer that he offers for his disciples, and not only for them, but for those who will believe based upon what they teach. He's praying for all. It's essentially a humility. Here is a man who's about ready to die, and he is concerned, again, for the welfare of his disciples and others. When he chooses the 12, in Luke 6, he goes right up to the mountain and he prays all night. He's praying about this very matter, very humbling. Luke 9, again, he's a leader in the perfect discipleship. He's showing what discipleship's all about. He says, you'll take up your cross and follow me. You lay down upon a pillow of rock at times. Things are not going to be so smooth. There's humiliation you get, you see. So teaching and wisdom is going to be an humbling effect. It's not going to be a power-grabbing effect. It's not going to be one that will exalt you or make you superior, and sometimes even it may even diminish you in some's eyes. Not because it should, but because it will. And certainly for those who are unbelievers, your job will be a thankless one in that regard. Because, again, who thinks of leaders as humbled creatures? They have authority. They have power, you see. But they're not to lord it, as even Peter will say. You see, it's important that we understand humility as a very important part of what it means to teach in wisdom and what it looks like. What about the servant, which really begets what we've already seen already? Go back to chapter 5 of 1 Peter. Therefore, I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elders and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God. Servants, in this particular case, is one who gives themselves up voluntarily. Elders, that's what you do. That's what teaching and wisdom looks like. You become a servant. Because it's so important to the very soul's salvation. God has given you that opportunity and given you that job in order to do that very matter. That's what's most important. There's nothing else. There's not a business of this church or any other church for that matter that is the Lord's that's more important than this. This humility and servanthood, this ideal of teaching and wisdom, they're all together. And of course, evangelistic. Yes. We don't usually think of it that way. We think of the elders, and he hires an evangelist, right? Again, don't get too weighted down and worry about whether or not he should be in the pulpit or not. That's not the argument. Let's go back to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 17. We kind of alluded to it earlier. We took an excerpt off of it because we were looking at another part. But notice in verse 17, he says, the elders who rule well are considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. And of course, he will go on to talk about that they're worthy of their hire and that you don't muzzle the ox who's threshing, right? You feed him. All right, but evangelistic. Evangelistic. In a very important way, a very needed way, it's going to be very one-on-one in many cases. It's going to be very personal. It's going to be one that's observant of the very needs of the congregation. It's going to know whether we have weak, strong, lost, with people who are falling away, those who are about to fall away. It's going to be able, you're going to be able to observe those things. Evangelistic, it's very comprehensive. It's to warn and yet at the same time to mold and shape. But one of the things that we need to see in respect to this ideal of an elder evangelist is one who knows the word well enough and sees, based upon his time in the faith, your strengths and your qualities to help you to grow. A lot of times we think of preacher trainings as an example, and some elder preacher or at least middle-aged preacher will take one under his wings and help teach him. This is exactly the qualities God's called the elder to be. Exactly. To take one under his wings. Not necessarily just to become a preacher, but to help to strengthen, to help to grow in the faith, to see certain qualities and bring those out and develop those things. To see those areas in which sin seems to be coming in and encroaching in and helping them to see the way of escape. You see that? That's what wisdom will do for you. That's what age will do for you. You say, you know, I've been down this road. I see where you're heading, and let me help you guide it. I know you really want to do what is right, but you don't always seem to see it. But I will help show you. That's how God shows us the way of escape. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. He's not going to say, Chuck, let me tell you, it's right over there. Go. He's going to send persons, yes. He will help me be aware of things. He certainly can work in all kinds of ways. But you know, oftentimes it's that simple. He will send someone my way. And what if it's you who is the elder, who has that opportunity to help me? What if you're not there? There's great dangers. Titus 1, 9 through 11, we'll talk about those things. You got to be wary of that. You got to be warned. You got to be worried about those that will come in. There are people who need to be shaped and molded to be even better so the church is even stronger and better than what it was. Because you want to know why churches just eventually die? Because everybody just assumes a whole lot of things and we get some basics down. And once we get those basics down, we go on our merry way. Either children will grow up to be mediocre Christians or haphazard, or they will not become Christians at all. Only a handful will actually grow up to be faithful and strong, and therefore that's a small percentage. And you just hope they might stick around. They might move off. And they might find some other place to go. And then you don't have them there. And then what do you have? You see, this is how it works. This is how God knew that the church would stay strong. He knew that if you put the right persons in place and that they did their job and they did it well, then the church would grow and mature and light would shine. That's why we talk about it from Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11. These persons were put into that place. But notice in Ephesians 4 and verse 15, speaking the truth in love that you may grow up, right? Later on in verse 16, he says very plainly, from whom the whole body being fitted and held together by whatever joint supplies according to the proper working of each individual part causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. And he said these people in verse 11 were given that job. He said apostles. He said prophets. He did say evangelists. No problem with all that. But he also did say, as we said earlier, pastors as well as teachers. And I'm here to submit to you that that'll be an important quality of a working elder. And that's what you will see even helping us in Romans chapter 6 verses 4 through 17 navigate this obedience and making sure that we are doing that which will cause us to be slaves of righteousness and not slaves of unholiness or disobedience. Philippians 1 and verses 9 through 11 that Paul is letting the church know, but again, I stress to you, this is a quality the elders may have or should have because of the title that will help. And I pray that your love may abound still more and more in real knowledge and all discernment, that you may approve the things that are excellent in order to be sincere and blameless in the day of Christ. That's exactly what the elders are to do, to help us. They're not here just to manage the business of whatever. They're here to help you make your way to heaven. Their job, in part, in very important part, is to teach, to mold, and to shape, so that you'll be filled with the fruit of righteousness which comes through Jesus Christ. And a healer. Now, whatever the context in James 5, 13 through 15, in other words, whether he is doing any physical healing and whether that has any effect, that's another matter. But it does talk about the fact that this prayer, this elder comes and he's called to pray so that you may be forgiven if you have sinned. To heal you spiritually, for certain. I know that. And therefore, he would finally conclude in James chapter 5 and verse 16, the effect and fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And the elder should be one of those, right? A healer. 2 Corinthians 2, 1 through 11, that's the context. Paul's saying, hey, you have restored this brother, good. Love him, heal him, strengthen him so that he doesn't continue to be discouraged. Build him back up. Strengthen him. Galatians 6, 1. Restore those who are in the sin and a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself. Elders are very primary in that. And we've already talked about 1 Thessalonians 5, 14, but it takes some time to read verses 12 through 23. And you will see the context there. And even though he's talking to the church, it is an important aspect and quality that the elders should have. And finally, to bear burdens. And so fulfill the law of Christ. You know, there are things that as you get older that you understand better. The person that is younger doesn't get it, and they're beside themselves. They can't see how they're going to be able to do that, how they're going to carry that load, whatever that case may be. And you know what? One who teaches in wisdom looks like this. Not to say that we're not to be burden bearers, but we need to have those who have a special quality, and elders should have that they're capable and able to do that. And finally, as you saw the slide earlier, they're going to be an example to the flock. That's exactly what he says in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 3, there at the end. He says, and on the process of doing the things that he's doing, not by compulsion, he says, to do it and live as an example. That means you're walking that walk that you've taught. That whatever illustrations, whatever counseling you give, whatever teaching you offer, whatever warning, whatever admonishment, whatever that guidance is, you're showing by example that that is good counsel. It is good counsel. Prove to be an example of the flock. This is what an elder looks like. One who teaches in wisdom. Because that's the two components. You have to have wisdom because you've been working and practicing as a Christian. And you have to be able to teach that. Show that wisdom. Impart that wisdom. And do it well. If you're here this morning, and you have not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have not been talking about that, I know, this morning. But we have been talking about that group of persons that can even help you in that. Oh, I certainly can help you in that. There's no question. Others can. But I'm here to ask you this morning. If you have any questions, do you have any concerns about what it means to be a Christian? Go to an elder. Go to one who is wise, hopefully to help instruct you in that pathway, to show you what you're missing or to explain what you're concerned about. But if you know this morning that you are in sin and you understand that Jesus is the answer, that you have come to understand that, then why are you waiting? Come, repenting of your sins, confessing Jesus as the Christ and being buried in water for the remission of your sins. And if you've done so but you've not been living as you should, you got an opportunity this morning to correct that as well. We can pray for one another, right? Effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, we've said. And therefore, we also know that God is faithful to forgive those who ask. 1 John 1, 9. And it just may be that it's been reproach upon the church and you need the help and the guidance. Hey, that's what we should be here for. That's one of our works, you see. And especially an opportunity for you to speak to the elders and get that wisdom instruction. Will you consider that? Come as we stand and sing the invitation song. Someday you'll stand at the bar of